logo be emblazoned upon a magical talisman, no label shall ever impart its influence upon the triumvirate which constitutes the inquisitive parcel of this roundest of tables. We are among friends, and there be no labels here. Let the no label round table commence!
Alright, well, what's up? This is Sean.
This is Miranda.
And Joe.
And we've got Andy with us. And we today are talking to Matt. What's your last name, Matt?
Wallop.
Matt Wallop.
Matt Wallop. Alright, man. And Matt is, he is like a food master. And I don't know. Actually, we'll just go ahead and let you explain kind of what it is that you do.
Well, I eat...
Me too.
I have something in common, and I'm in the mindset that I don't eat to live. I eat because I need food to survive. I live so that I can eat food to survive.
That's sweet.
I study foods of the world, and I study cuisine, and I study how what role that plays not only in the lives and the cultures and the way of life and the day-to-day activity of people from all over the world, but also how that affects their relationships with neighbors, how that affects their relationships with each other. One of my causes that I would champion more than anything right now is that the number one thing I would ask us to do in America is to take our food off our lap and out of our car and put it on a table and gather around with other people spend some time and eat and talk and converse and share and commune with each other. And it could
break
be the
bread.
Same. Break bread.
Break bread.
And thank you for that, because it's interesting, because that act, which is completely lost in so many parts of our lives these days, is so important to the essence of life and spirit and everything else that it is actually biblical. The most influential thing that ever happened in the entire Bible was somebody breaking bread and drinking wine together.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It, like, changed the world. Okay?
Warring kings would sit down and break bread and be like, all right, so what are you doing over there?
Right, that's right.
What are you doing over there? Well,
the Last Supper.
How do you like the whatever?
Yeah.
Oh, it's pretty good. Try some of this.
Yeah. This is good.
A group of people broke some bread, drank some wine, and our calendar started again.
Wow,
think about it. AD happened after that event.
Yeah.
Because next day the man went down.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have decided that we're going to start measuring time again. This is a big deal, and it all centered around a meal.
Was the Last Supper? He didn't eat a last breakfast the next day before he got
he didn't
carted
have a
off.
No, actually, on the way to work.
Hours in the morning.
He hadn't read any of the fitness magazines yet.
Truth is,
So before we
somebody kissed him on the cheek and it was
and it was over. If we go back in a little bit in time, where did you grow up, and then how did your interest in food begin to where you are today?
Great question.
By the way, we're at the world famous Wonder Bar doing this right now, and we're not breaking bread, but we're breaking barley. So anyway, sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
Bread can be a very principal component, or barley can be in bread.
Yeah.
I am a fourth generation Wyoming resident from up in the Bighorn Mountains. My family established a ranch where the Little Goose River comes flowing out of a canyon in a little corner of the mountains by Bighorn, Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up on a working ranch that had cattle and sheep and pigs and cows and dairy and chickens and all those things. We also had a very large garden. We had a 2-acre garden not just for us, but everybody who worked the ranch and lived on the ranch had access to portions of that to raise food for themselves. We had root cellars. We had a 1-acre orchard that had apple trees and pear trees. It even had one peach tree, which I think maybe once in my life actually produced some fruit.
That's awesome, man.
We had grapevines. We had gooseberry bushes.
Oh,
we foraged for watercress and the little irrigation streams that float through there. We hunt for elk and deer and ducks and pheasants. We fished rivers. We fished lakes. We ate all the food that came out of that. We went to the mountains. We foraged for morel mushrooms and porcini mushrooms and even some chanterelle mushrooms on the rare occasion we could find them. Wild ramps, which are a type of wild leek. And, you know, I discovered those. I mean, I didn't discover them. My dad knew about them. But I was blown away because we would be hiking through the mountains or riding horseback through the mountains, and all of a sudden you just smell onion.
Onion, yeah.
Yeah, wow. And you wouldn't know why. You're like, why does it just smell like onions here? Well, you're actually walking through a meadow where ramps are just growing, and it's kind of swampy there, and you can pull those out. I mean, you can imagine. You've got currants, and you've got ramps, and you have watercress, and you catch a fish, and you know, you got a little butter with you, and you put all that together in a foil, and you throw it in a campfire, and let that all cook up, and then you open that up and eat it, and it's an incredible experience.
That's amazing.
You know? And it all came from just, you know, you're just walking along the woods, and there it is.
Wow.
And we got up and milked cows at 4 o'clock in the morning. My dad had a refrigerator in the pantry of off our kitchen that didn't have any shelves in it. And we get the metal canisters of milk right after we would milk the cows. And we'd put those in there, and then we'd go get cleaned up and get ready for the rest of the day. And we'd come down to have our breakfast. And we'd take our Rice Krispies and open up one of those canisters. And all the cream, of course, would be sitting on the top. And it was, like, so thick, you had to scoop it out of there. Curl it, like ice cream. Curl it out of it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And we would like plop that on a Rice Krispies.
Yeah.
There's no snap, crackle, and pop when you got heavy, thick stuff like that.
Yeah.
You kind of stir it all in there, and then you got this buttery, crunchy. And that was our breakfast in the morning. So it's interesting, you know, it's just an interesting way to grow up. And you know, my dad always made his own salad dressings. I never had like bottled salad dressing until I think I was 17 years old. It's the first time I ever had salad dressing out of a bottle, because we would just a little vinegar, a little oil, a couple dried herbs, maybe some Dijon or some powdered thing. And then he also had this one technique, and I'm sharing this with everybody, so pay attention. Right? He would take a little piece of ice and crack it, and take a couple pieces of this ice cube that was cracked and put it in the salad dressing and whisk that into it, because the cold would chill down the oil and it would emulsify and it wouldn't separate.
Oh, whoa.
So the entire dinner it would stay together emulsified.
What?
And it wouldn't be separate the vinegar and the oil.
What?
That's because cool. You add just a little bit of ice to it and mix that all into it.
Oh my goodness.
You know, and it works. Try it. You know, put a little ice in your bowl of salad dressing when you're whipping that up.
That story you're telling about the wild onions or what are ramps?
Ramps, yeah.
Oh, ramps.
And it's funny because ramps is like an exotic ingredient that like somebody uses them in a big city restaurant these days, and they can like jack up the price on the dishes using wild ramps.
Yeah.
And what? I kicked that stuff out of the way when I was
walking over it for years before I figured out you could eat it.
There was some sort of, when I used to mow lawns for a living, there was this lady out in Mills that had some sort of wild onions growing in her grass. And the first time I went out there and I cut into a whole shitload of those with a weed eater, and it just sprayed wild onion juice all over me, dude. And I just smelled like it. And that was like an early lawn, and it just the whole rest of the day, I just smelled like onions. It was brutal.
That'll learn you.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Sure will.
So,
that's awesome. That's awesome.
So you grew up very in touch with your food, or it was just your life?
It was very much in touch with the food and knowing where food came from and having a passion for like respecting it. You know, it's I was having this discussion yesterday. You know, a hunter society has all kinds of lore and principles and things that when you make the kill, there's a certain ritual that you do to respect the animal who's feeding you, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that comes from a hunter society and even a gatherer society, but, you know, that animalistic thing. And we have a tendency in modern-day America to kind of condemn those people that don't feel that way. Mm-hmm. But if you think about ancient European cultures, you know, at some point, quite a long time ago, hunting, I mean, there's not a lot of people who go hunting in France, right?
Right.
I mean, they have such a rich farm and animal raising community and food community, everything, that everything is nurtured within a pen and within the act of taking care of these animals and everything and raising them. You're not going out and killing something in the wild to eat in these cultures, and probably haven't for hundreds of years, other than the few elite that do it just for recreational purposes. Mm-hmm. So they have lost that connection, and to no fault of their own. I mean, you know,
it's progress.
Yeah, it is progress, and it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they got, like, you can go to New Zealand and there's almost no restaurant or no community that doesn't have pig farms, you know, where all the food waste and everything gets thrown in there and the pigs are harvested and fed, and they're not having a ritual over the killing of the pig. And
right.
You have to, the first pig you ever kill as a young child, you have to drink the blood out of its neck or anything like that.
Right. Right.
Because this is just how we do things, you know. It's not that kind of thing, and that's it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, but we had both. I grew up having both because I had my first kill, and I didn't have to drink. We didn't do the thing where you drink the blood, but I knew people, neighbors and friends that lived in the area where they did. Mm-hmm. You know, but the first meal we ever had after we got a kill was the liver of that animal. It was the first meal we had, and it was spectacular. Yeah. And it was something that we, as kids and as family, truly looked forward to every hunting season, was that incredible liver dinner we'd have every night. And that was part of appreciating and knowing that this is providing us sustenance for our lives.
Right.
And we had the fatted calf, just like anybody else. You know, we had cattle herds, and we also owned the largest packing plant in the northern part of the state at the time. So I grew up in a butcher, you know, packing plant where we slaughtered animals and the whole thing, and I know how to break down animals and all that. But we would fish, you know. It's just, it's a complete connection. You never forget it. You never think about anything else. I mean, as a kid in the garden, we used to run out there and pull onions straight out of the ground on a hot summer day. Hot, warm onions straight out of the ground. And rub the dirt off on our shirt and eat it like an apple.
Yeah.
Right? Sweet. And it was so sweet and amazing and delicious and amazing. We get hiccups immediately right after.
Yeah.
but we just loved and rejoiced that. And it's like, it's hard for me to imagine a life that doesn't have that, you know?
Yeah.
That, like, you don't get that. You know, and you hear the stories about people in cities and stuff that don't know the milk comes from cows and whatever. It's like, okay, maybe there's people that don't know that, but it's hard to believe that that's really a significant part of the population.
It probably isn't,
actually.
Yeah.
So,
thank you.
So there's that, you know, there's just that eternal life of connection to it all.
Right.
And my dad was a very passionate cook.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, very passionate cook. Although, during the summers when we're running the ranch and it's a very busy time of year and everybody's just working like dogs, he always hired a cook. And he would hire people who were trained in France and stuff like this that would go and cook. So I also then, like, spent a lot of time because I thought that was fascinating, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you
and I love to tell
him
a story about my dad, because his meal was breakfast, right? And he got up at like 4 o'clock in the morning. And if we were game enough to get up that early, we'd come down, dad would cook us breakfast. And one of the things he would always do is he would pull the bacon off the slab, the chunk of bacon, he'd pull each slice and each slab off of there, and he'd be putting it in the pan and getting it ready to cook, and we'd all be standing there watching. And one time he pulled the slab of bacon off and just continued the action and just slapped one of those slabs of bacon smack up across the face of what it was. They were like, "Dad, gross!" close, you know. We're like screaming and yelling, but I guarantee you, every single morning, we're all jockeying for position to get that piece of bacon slapped upside the face.
Oh, yeah.
So it's all centered around that community. That community of the table, the community of the kitchen, the community of hanging and being about food. Yeah. And then just to kind of complete that picture, he also rarely came home from town if he had a major errand or a business meeting in town or something without bringing somebody with him to eat with us. And there were always people. Every holiday, not one holiday ever went by in our household where Dad didn't find somebody who was displaced or, you know, had, you know, was on hard times or whatever, where he didn't invite them to come to the Christmas dinner or the Thanksgiving feast or whatever. We always had extra people invited around the table.
Awesome.
And our meals were 4 and 5 hours long. And we would sit and we would eat and we'd drink and talk and laugh and joke and tell stories, and it never ended.
Yeah.
It never ended.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's what that the role of eating and food and cuisine and cooking and all that, it has to play that role in our lives, in our society, because it binds us all together in more ways than just survival,
mm-hmm.
because we eat so we can live.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we eat for more reasons than that.
Yes.
There's a spiritual and a cultural connection that has to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that is a big passion of mine.
Yeah, and that is gone from so many of our lives as Americans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that growing up with my family and stuff, but... because we'd eat at the table every night.
Hate
but like,
or love
I just don't
either
see.
Either way.
Yeah.
those are some of the still family moments, even if you're like, right,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
It has, you know, it has diminished.
Yeah.
But like, while we were talking about, you know, like European countries, and that's still very prominent over there. And like, I mean, like, I don't know, Spain, for instance, they'll always eat a late dinner, I guess, you know, is traditional late night. And you do it kind of like as we are right now with drinks and, you know, it's way more social thing. Like, you wait for dinner until it's late,
strong.
And it's like the social hour, you know, sort of thing. And like,
relaxing and not so stressful, where we're just like, we only have so much time shoving food in our faces fast.
Give me the Soylent Green so I can get out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that also brings up a good point of not just the importance of the ritual of community, but also the quality of your food.
Mm-hmm.
It can't just be anything.
It should mean something. It should be the best that you can obtain for within the boundaries of what your life can provide for you.
Right.
And it's interesting because our government supplements farms like crazy to produce mass quantities of food that's not healthy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that we need to bring that back a little bit and say, okay, like... we need the supplement to be towards something that's going to make us stronger, richer,
that can exist,
healthier.
But our tax dollars aren't going to go towards growing that when we could be spending it on. Yeah,
right.
Totally.
We will supplement a farm, and you know, I mean, I could go on and on about interesting facts. You know, 45% of the food we raise in this country is thrown into landfills and is never consumed at all for anything. You know, and so much of that is actually supplemented by the government to grow. Where the government is paying to make sure this fruit is grown and then it gets thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
And a small farmer in a small community or organizations like, and I will mention this and you can decide what to do with it, but Wyoming Food for Thought, who wants to establish community gardens to find a way to have good, well-raised, wholesome food put into a bank that is offered to nutritionally restricted and challenged youth in our community. There's a supplement.
Exactly.
It's not a farm that's going to throw 45% of the food away and go to waste. That's the supplement.
Yes.
That's what we have to focus our energy in on.
Mm-hmm.
And that relationship between consumer and grower needs to connect to where we get to know these people. We respect them as a part of our community and culture. You know, we live in Casper, and our ability to grow a wide variety of foods and have that available year-round is not like it would be, you know, in South Carolina. I get all that. And there are some ways we could do that, but they're expensive. But that needs to be the thought, and that needs to be the direction and the focus of how we as a society and as a governing body move.
100% doesn't mean we shouldn't go that route.
Yeah, so you don't just disregard it completely.
Right, well, this is easier. And just
and bring in another can of spam.
Right, yes. Oh, yeah. Right. Well, and then there's that documentary, A Place at the Table, that just shows how crazy it is that, like, not only are those foods just unhealthy, but because they're the cheapest, because of subsidies, that's what, like, our poorest people are eating is, like, they're going for, like, high value foods, like, you know, boxed chocolate malts or whatever, you know, and that's what they're living off of. So then, and then we're paying their healthcare costs. It's like, we are contributing to the demise of our own people.
That's a great
all
point.
We have to do is just, but, you know, they have limited access to foods, and so, and to resources like a kitchen or whatever. So to really eat well, if you're poor on food stamps, like, it's pretty dang difficult.
Yeah, and
it's all because it's the cheapest stuff is the subsidized stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I worked for the Housing Authority for a year and was part of the Housing First Project, which works with chronically homeless people and everything. And you know, if I can soapbox for just a second, and I know I'm kind of dominating
soapbox
here, but this stuff drives me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can we swear on this thing?
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
It drives me fucking
mad.
Because you'll read about how I saw a mother wearing, you know, Ralph Lauren clothing and buying Snicker bars with food stamps for her kids and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
Look, the sustenance food program is in major crisis, but it is not the people using the food stamps. We're talking $17 a month, some of these individuals, is all they get in food stamps.
Yeah.
Like, what is that going to buy you? That buys you nothing at all.
Yeah.
But the people who administer the food stamps, the organizations that are there to provide the assistance for people who need housing, people who need food stamps, people who need assistance in by the government to help them with their health care and everything else will run an 85% to 90% administrative cost. So the government is giving them $100,000 and they're spending $80,000 to $90,000 of it just to administer. So there's only $10,000 left to spread amongst these people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're driving around in Cadillacs. And this is happening in our community. And I know who they are, and I can see them driving down the street. And I'm telling you, this is a crisis.
Yeah.
It's a crisis. And it's HUD, and HUD's the most distorted, fucked up organization in our entire government. Yeah. And they're the ones that are administering billions and trillions of government dollars that are supposed to be going out to help those people who are in need.
Meanwhile, the people
and we look
need
at it as
shamed.
The problem is
look at all those leeches that are feeding
soccer moms using food stamps and shit like that. Man, it's like no, you're
right.
Not that man.
Who gave them that?
It's not that problem.
Who gave them that?
Right. And why did they only give them $70 a month?
Yeah.
No, a family of four, a family of five might get $175 a month in food stamps. You know, like we are a family of four, and I run a very tight budget on our food because I can, because I know how to, right?
Yes.
And I know how to do this. I mean, this has been the last 25 years of my life, of my career, has been budgeting food.
You optimally.
You know, I run a restaurant, I know how to budget food, right? And we're running about $250 a month. So here is a family of four with $150, $175 a month for their entire assistance in their food because. And so what are they going
to
do with it? They're going to be buying frozen food. They're going to be buying. They're going to do exactly what you brought up. Your point exactly is going to be what happens. Because how else are you going to stretch it?
Yeah, right. You exactly.
They're not buying part of a cow.
No.
And, you know, like sacks of potatoes or whatever, bags of flour. Mm-hmm. You could live off of that. You know, you could make a whole shitload of tortillas for
they're
that
They're buying
much.
Easy Mac.
But they're buying a box of it and going, put this box with this box and then you have food now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally.
Ramen. Mm-hmm.
But then you compound the problem because that food actually creates an addictive nature in our brains and in our bodies, right?
Yes.
So now they're dependent on that food physically.
Yes.
Dependent on that. And they can't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we are glossing over hunger
with frosting.
And
But that frosting, once cut through, is going to reveal a health crisis in this country, which we're already seeing, and it's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
Because this stuff is killing us.
It is. Absolutely. You can see it.
We're going to go broke on the medical bills alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are.
And then we're going to die. Andy and I, we joke about it, but it's actually really morbidly true. Like, there will be people who starve to death with canned food in their house.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, things are going to happen one day because we don't know how to cook. We don't know how to do food, basically.
No,
really.
We don't.
Like, we only know how to, like, receive it and put in our faces.
Yeah.
We don't know the secrets of making it that are so simple, but that just make your food enjoyable, like being able to make a pan sauce, being able to just anything. Just anything. So yeah, there is
exactly.
Yeah.
I guess that's a good way to segue into what it is that you want to do with food. Like what's your dream?
Where do you divert or put all the energy?
Well, what was the first thing you did with food as far as a job?
The first thing I did is actually I was like, I graduated from college, you know, and I moved to Seattle, and that's a great food community up in the Northwest.
Wonderful.
It's incredible. And everything is, if it's not grown there, it either can't be or it's not eaten, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very passionate about it. And I actually hooked up with Nordstrom and I was doing the whole corporate retail thing. And I worked my way up that corporate ladder. And the higher up I got, the sooner in the day the little cramps were starting to develop in my shoulders and the tension in my anxiety would elevate and I'd snap at people that I loved and cared about and was not that much fun to be around. And I kept climbing higher and it got worse.
Upper management material.
I'm perfect for it, right? But for me, you know, that food thing like was my soul and survival, right? So I would always, I'd get off work and I would just drive home and I'd hit the Giant Gourmet and I'd just go in and buy some greens, a bottle of wine, and I'd go home. Put a little Ray Charles on the stereo,
that's
right?
Awesome.
Crank it up, start singing along with Ray, you know, and cooking, and like it's everything just melted away, and life was okay again. And not like all my friends were way into this stuff because I was like I was just researching. I was already researching world cuisines and how to cook and all this other kind of stuff. And I mentioned my dad was incredibly accomplished and great hobby cook, and I would spend so many hours getting bacon slapped in my face and loving and enjoying everything that he was about. And this was just becoming a part of it, and everybody kept saying, you need to become a chef, and you need to have your own restaurant. And I poo-pooed it and put it off, and I just said, I just want to do this. But one day, the company was going through some labor issues, and so they had some morale issues going with management. I wasn't upper management, with management. And they decided to have a seminar that was going to get everybody fired up and refocused. And so they brought in one of those speakers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave all the managers this 3 days
to
lead their department.
And they were going to get all fired up. And the topic of the subject is, if you love what you do every single day for a living, you will never actually work another day of your life.
So you're like, cool,
right?
Fucking later, dudes.
That's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened.
It had its intended
because
effect.
Because like after the end of the 3 days, I'm like going, okay, well, I know what that is.
You're pretty much,
and I'm putting in my resignation this week.
That's awesome.
And I stepped out.
You motivated me right the fuck on out of here.
That's right. I went to culinary school and I was gone, man. I was out the door. Then I moved to Portland and I went through culinary school and, you know, was just digging it, you know, was was doing my whole thing, and I moved up to Seattle and was working.
I think so.
And I was living in Seattle and just, you know, really connecting to, like, the farm-to-table movement, which was really in its infancy.
Oh, yeah.
But up there, it was still kind of a thing. I mean, it wasn't really that, but people were interested in seasonal, and there was the new American cuisine, which is an understanding that America is a melting pot of multiple cultures. And as long as you respect the technique and the concepts of a foreign dish, you can use whatever local and indigenous ingredients are a part of it, and you're not bastardizing the dish,
okay, yeah.
Which is different than fusion.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So it's not really fusion.
It's not like, fusion
this
at
is
all.
Our version right. for this yeah. place in the world. Yeah.
The technique's the same, yeah. and the seasoning's the same, and the soul and the character of the dish is the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just, you know, my perfect example, I adopted a daughter from Vietnam, and we went to Hanoi, and there is a restaurant in Hanoi called Chak La Van, and it's on the 50 things you got to do before you die bucket list, right, is to go to Chak La Van, and they only have one dish on the menu, but they do give you a menu. But it only has one dish on it.
Oh, that's so good. So you can like your name.
That's awesome.
Yeah, right.
No.
Do you have some time? You want some time?
Yeah.
It's awesome.
That's
so
hilarious.
And I mean, I could tell you the whole story, but it's essentially you get this one dish, and it's a river fish that is cooked with some turmeric and some seasonings and stuff like that, and then it's brought out, and they bring this cauldron of coals with a pan that they cook this fish in with all the oil and the seasonings and everything, and that sits in the center of your table. And then there's an array of all these herbs and seasonings and noodles and nuts and all these other kind of things in a little bowl, and you pull some noodles and you take some of the fish and you put it in there and you add some of the herbs and add some nuts and sprinkle a little fish sauce or whatever on it, and you build yourself a little bowl and you eat it, and then you get to build another bowl and another
thing. That does sound good.
And it's a really great dish, and it's a river fish dish. It's made from river fish, which is carp. You know, in Hanoi, it's carp is in the rivers there, and it's a very sacred fish there. Carp is part of like all their like religious and everything else. There's all kinds of imagery of carp saving the world and people riding carp to the sky.
That's badass.
No, I think
here we just we pull them out of the river and chuck them against a rock here.
Yeah.
Like we really do, dude. Like
me too.
I was always told that you're supposed to kill them.
Yeah, you know, they're a bad fish here. And probably for good reason, because the reason carp's such a dominant fish there is because the only thing that survives because the carp's killing and eating everything else in the river.
Yeah.
You know, but it is what they eat there, and it was an incredibly delicious dish.
I mean, you went there and it was your local version of river.
But I came back and I said, okay, how do I do this dish? Mm-hmm. Okay, how do I do this dish in my restaurant in Sheridan, Wyoming? Well, I'm not using carp. But our river fish is trout.
Mm-hmm.
So we took a, you know, butterfly boned whole trout, and we wok fried it. You know, we seasoned it the same way, and we did it in the oil, and we did it in a wok, and we added all the turmeric and all the seasonings. And our culture doesn't really like to build their own food in their own bowl, right, by practice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we basically finished it, but all with the same noodles, the wide rice noodles, you know, they're a pad thai noodle. You know, all the herbs are there. We sprinkled the peanuts over it. We used the fish sauce. We made the concoction. We did everything else. It was very authentic to the dish. It was just local.
Right.
I wasn't ordering carp from around the world just to make it authentic.
Right.
It's still authentic.
Yeah.
But I also wasn't adding sauerkraut to it to make it fusion.
Yeah. Gotcha.
You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
Yes. That makes so much sense.
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, now I got distracted.
Trout works.
You have, is this, did you have a restaurant then, you said, in Sheridan?
Yeah, you
were doing that, Sheridan's version of that.
Yeah, so I my sister called me, and I was living the life in Seattle. And my sister called me, she says, there's a little restaurant for sale here in Sheridan. I go, well, that's too bad, because I am not going back to Wyoming, you know. But I had vacation time I had to use before the end of the year, and it was October. you know. So what the hell, I'll go visit my brother, we'll do a little fishing. I'll use checking out the restaurant as an excuse.
Yeah.
And I'll go do some fishing because I'm loving my life. I got season tickets to the Mariners, I'm all in, right?
Sweet.
Well, October, you don't come back to Wyoming in October and leave with a, boy, I'm glad I'm leaving this place kind of feeling.
Yeah.
It's one of those months that are really amazing to me.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It is, especially in that area. It's
perfect.
Yeah.
That's when we get our fall for a couple weeks.
It's so spectacular.
Well, and up there you get actually fall for maybe a month.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we were fishing and it was gorgeous and... You know, and the rest of them was there, and it was a pretty good deal on it and everything. And, you know, I was just toying with that. There was this thing saying, do your own thing. Do it your way. Do your food. You know, it just kept calling at me. But there's no way I was going to do it because I love my life. But I went back, and pretty soon, that little voice that was going on over here kept making me look at my life there from a little different paradigm.
Yeah.
And I started to realize that, you know, there's some shit going on in this community I'm not in with.
Yeah.
You know, I am a Westerner. I am I am reasonably conservative. You know, I'm not, you know, I don't particularly love the bumper sticker that says, welcome to Wyoming, consider all of us armed.
Right.
I'm not, you know, we're not all packing ready to shoot you down. You know? I'm not, I don't really want to be represented that way necessarily. Yeah. But, you know, I still did grow up in a pretty conservative life, you know, and with good reason. Yeah.
You know how to look at that bumper sticker and chuckle to yourself. Right. Oh, I know that guy.
I know why you think that.
Yeah, I know that guy. Exactly.
God bless you, but shut the fuck up.
It's funny, man. I park when I pull into work next to a guy with that bumper sticker every day.
And he probably's got the little sticker decals that look like bullet holes all over his vehicle.
He's a mega guy.
He's been down and had a shootout.
Great guy, but
You're like, that's not me, but you're my neighbor.
So you are Wyomingites.
So in the end, I said, you know what? I'm doing it. And... on December 27th, I took over this little tiny 29-seat bistro in Sheridan, Wyoming.
Oh, nice.
Wow, right on.
Which evolved into, 5 years later, a 137-seat restaurant with bar and banquet facility, wine, bread and cheese, gourmet food store in the back.
In Sheridan?
In Sheridan. What? It was called Oliver's Bar and Grill.
Because I grew up in Sheridan, but you came about like right after I had just left or whatever.
Yeah, 2001.
Okay.
And that's right when I moved there, and I ate there, and I'm so glad.
I didn't know that it started. That you got it when it was before Oliver's, right? And kind of grew it into that, or is that right?
Well, the guys that had Chow before I moved, so you knew the guys that had Chow Bistro, which was the restaurant that I bought.
That is so
Kevin
crazy.
and Jim, although. I think it was Jim, Kevin and Jim, and Jim passed away, and Kevin had it on his own, and it was just a burden, and it was had too many memories for his partner, and so he put it up for sale, and I ended up buying it, and that's how this all happened. So that's fabulous to have a connection.
Yeah,
with you.
I ate
there.
I know why that calls you back.
I'm glad that because I just don't know how to ask what I was eating. The internet, I don't know how to Google it properly to find out exactly what it was, but there was a it was a Brazilian plate, I think, with like a type of sausage.
Argentinian,
okay. Yeah. And there was a sauce with it that was like a spinach, I want to say.
Chimichurri sauce. And it's an Argentinian condiment. And that's,
I don't know what to call
that. That is such a great segue. God bless you for bringing this up.
I just have to say that was one of the best things I had ever had.
Yeah, because it's an oregano, parsley, garlic. There's many variations. Mint can often be a part of it.
Uh-huh.
Vinegar and oil concoction that is complemented on... carne asada, which is part of a dining event that exists in that is a big part of the culture of Argentina, especially out in the Patagonia, which is called the asada parrilla.
Okay,
and what they do is they go out in the middle of the Patagonia or the prairie, and they will build a fire and they burn this fire for 3 or 4 days, right? And they put all this grids and tables and everything over the top of this huge fire pit, right? Mm-hmm. And then they they build a tent, or sometimes they do it in a place that's got a lean-to that's built in there, right? Mm-hmm. And then after 3 or 4 days, when the coals have all done it, and they get like a pit where they bury stuff and cook mm-hmm. it in a pit, mm-hmm. and they keep coals running on another one, and they cook stuff on an iron table they set over the top of the fire, mm-hmm. and so they'll cook things like on essentially a gigantic griddle,
yeah,
right, that's over the top of fire. They'll hang game birds and chickens from wires over a scaffolding that goes over the top of the fire, and it just sits and roasts in the top of the fire. Yeah. They take lamb and other animals, and they'll put them in a cage, and they'll ground that next to the fire, and they keep mm-hmm. turning it, and it actually roasts by the heat of the fire, the radiant heat that comes on the fire. And this happens for days on end, and then everybody gathers, and there's just tons of wine, and there's potatoes that are coming out of the fire, and there's all this meat, and that's the condiment mm-hmm. Is the chimichurri. That's the condiment for all this meat that comes off, and that's mm-hmm. bowls of that are passed around. They have spinach and like innards are a big part of what you eat out there. And you just sit for 4, 5, 6, 7 hours and just eat and drink wine as the sun's going down and it goes on. And pretty much everybody kind of camps out there and everything else, and then they wake up the next day and go on about their life.
That sounds like the world's best party.
Does it not? Does it not?
It sounds wonderful. I can get behind that.
Right?
Yeah. I am going to do
for 8 hours.
Yeah. Oh my god.
And Asada Perea. In Shirley Basin, because when I drive through Shirley Basin, I say, "This is the Patagonia, man. This looks just like the Patagonia."
Oh my gosh! Well,
and I'm working on it. I mean, we got to find the land, and we got to get people to agree, and we got to get it all publicized. But when that all happens, and would you, for an event like this, drop $100?
Oh, hands down. Yes.
Can I camp?
You're going to camp there and everything else. And you're going to come out, and it's just going to be all this amazing food that's going to come and everything else that's going to come your way. Like, I feel like this is an event that would be a big time.
You would look forward to all year long.
Yeah. And this is something that is
totally look to all year long.
You know, a long way to bring it back to your point that you asked me, you know, what are my plans?
Yeah.
My plan is that, like, I've done the restaurant thing. I've worked in a corporate kitchen. Yeah. I've worked for people. I nearly lost my family. I lost my soul. I lost mm-hmm. my spirit. I lost my health. Mm-hmm. I lost so much by just driving to meet the common American concept of what I'm supposed to do, or the expectations of my employer, or the expectations of my investors, the expectations of my small community where I tried to do things that were outside of their scope. We really changed things a lot up in Sheridan, and I'm so proud of what all of us did. And in the end, it really came down to a dispute over real estate that brought it to its conclusion. I stepped away for the last 2 years, almost 2.5 years. I stepped away from the kitchen, and I just said, I can't do this anymore. I'm burnt out. Like, my wife hates me. My kids don't know who I am. I can't do this anymore. But in that time, I kind of started to say, okay, I have to do this. Mm-hmm. But how do I have
what
to
version,
do
this? Right.
Who am I?
Yeah.
You know, and what is it that I do? Mm-hmm. And I'm discovering that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I realize is that I am a Wyoming native.
Yeah.
And I am a Western Plains State native. This is who I am, right?
Yeah.
And this is who we are. Mm-hmm. And who are we, culinarily speaking?
Mm-hmm.
Who are we? Mm-hmm. You know, can you define that?
I think it's hard to define.
Who are we, Joe?
Americans.
I'd say we're meat and potatoes.
Yeah, that's.
But are we a meat and potatoes, or are we who moved here meat and potatoes?
That's what I mean. It's hard to say. For a culture fully bent, or a culture for a place. You know, there's the debate: does America have a culture? So that follows from that same thing. Do we have a cuisine that's uniquely...
Here in this part of the world.
Yeah, exactly.
But we did.
We did. At some
because there are natives that were here for centuries, right? And, you know, they learned to hunt. They learned what you can eat from the land that this produces, which is rough and difficult and challenging and seasonal and windy and cold and hot
shitty,
and dry and sandy and sagey and everything else. But they figured out there's still food here, and mm-hmm. we still have established a life here. And if they had been like a European culture, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, you know, you look at French cuisine and all the haute cuisines of the world, and these are cultures that, you know, discovered fire centuries, you know, many, many centuries ago, and began to learn to develop new pans and vessels to cook, and ways to cook, and ways to raise food, and to grow food, and to harvest food, and to cook it, and to feed communities with it, and how communities develop around it. And we're talking around here, it was nomadic and everything else, right? But what happened to it? Well, it essentially, the Western movement of Easterners mm-hmm. kind of cut that off. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just ended there, right? It ended there. Mm-hmm. So what if native plains food had been haute and not only uninterrupted, mm-hmm. but had been part of development and knew how to find iron and, mm-hmm. and create vessels and everything mm-hmm. else? What if that would be, what would the cuisine be like today? Yeah, so my thing is, I want to go back and say, okay, what is it that this land provided, and how did people sustain themselves, and how they cook it? And so much of it is around fire, and there is nobody in this world that doesn't like food that's cooked on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we already have an appeal because this food's going to be cooked on fire. But what if ways of preservation, ways of harvesting, ways of raising, ways of perpetuating and combining things, and ways of importing spices, cumin or chili peppers from a little bit further south, salt from salt mines, and all these things were to become part of it, and how would that cuisine have developed, and where would it be today? And my mission right now is to go out and find out what all that is. And go to the yak farm that's out in west central Wyoming, and go out and forage and go work and find the sage and find out what food tastes like if you take tumbleweeds and you take the gnarly sage wood and burn it as part of something that creates a fire, that creates coals to cook, and how would food develop in it? Buffalo and deer and sage grouse and rabbit and all these other kind of foods, and then bring them together, and then understanding what we can do with cooking techniques and modern equipment and modern technology and everything else. How can we take those dishes, you know, and turn them into something that is like truly haute cuisine and beautiful and gorgeous and fascinating in flavor. And would sustain societies for centuries before the Westerners ever, or the Easterners ever became Westerners.
Yeah, yeah.
And what would it look like? And then throw in the fact that the Basque became a part of this.
Yeah. Right.
And the Spaniards became a part of this.
Yeah.
And the certain...
And started borrowing
certain,
instead of...
Yeah, exactly.
Trades that would be open.
English people who, you know, who made their way west. Because, like, you know, we sit here in Casper and... Like, who were the first people to decide to make this a place to live? They weren't headed for Casper.
No, they broke down. We all admit it. They broke down.
They are settlers.
Somebody's wife was like, "You're not going another goddamn foot. We're going to die here."
So right. That is so right. Yeah.
That is exactly right.
That's how Casper happened.
And it is exactly how Casper happened. It's so much in this part of the world. And that's not a bad thing, but it harkens that advertisement for DirecTV, you know, and it's like, oh, why can't we get DirecTV instead of cable? Because we're settlers, son.
Oh, yeah.
We settle for things. Yeah. Well, we damn well settle, because you know they're headed for Oregon. Yeah. And I'm telling you, if they had got there, they would have been much happier.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Then they got the Donner Party, dude.
Yeah, right.
Talk about that cuisine. Yeah.
But nevertheless, here we are, you know? So, like, what does that mean? How do we say, okay, what are we going to do with that?
Yeah.
Right? And how we can turn that into that.
How do you slow cook an antelope and make it succulent?
Right.
So I don't know.
Like, hey, man, antelope. Who would have thought?
I'm telling you, man.
That's
will,
so good. I can't wait. I want to be along every step of the way as you
Dude, what,
well, I want you to be
develop this or
yes,
undevelop this.
I definitely do.
What you were saying about fire and like how there is nobody, like there literally probably isn't a person on Earth, literally, that doesn't like something cooked over fire.
No. Mm-hmm.
And like it's become part of our taste like throughout time. But I listened to, I can't, and God, I'm trying to remember where I heard this, but it, like human evolution is so closely centered around our ability, when we discovered fire and the ability to cook meat over fire, and it had something to do with just the way that our entire societies have developed, and it all basically harkens back to that, to cooking around fire, and how that like basically gave us community and society as we know it, and like it is
sanctified,
like,
eating. It was like this is now an act that nobody's going to be doing anything else when you're cooking meat over the fire.
Right? Yeah.
No one's going to be doing anything.
So
right?
Else. And like, dogs get slapped by the bacon.
They're going to be standing there waiting.
Really? Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That thing's done.
Right. Well, and you know, like the story of Prometheus, and like there's so many creations, sagas, and stuff that have that element of like of being like given humans fire from the gods and stuff, and like how that also represents knowledge, but yeah, like I just, it was so interesting, and I wish I could remember it, but that all, it also had to do with like how dogs were domesticated too, because they figured that dogs were wild, of course, but they would hang around little camps, and humans, they'd get like scraps, and so it just kind of became like this coexistence where dogs began to trust people.
Yeah.
People began to trust dogs.
And the dogs would be an alarm. Like you could tell at night, the dogs would be barking, what's that?
Right.
It became a perfectly symbiotic relationship.
Right, exactly. Wow. And that's how that happened, yeah. So, but it's crazy. Oh, man.
The harnessing of fire is the beginning of civilized man.
Right.
And it is completely related. And prior to that, it was so, like, what fire does to food is it makes it more tasteful. It makes it significantly more digestible. It also makes it significantly more healthful because it kills bacteria that can kill mankind and everything else.
Right.
But it was such a... It was before we harnessed fire, the anthropologists have discovered that like, humankind would... If there was a big fire, natural fire that would exist, they would all flock to that fire area. And once the fire burned out, they would go in and forage for burnt animals, like animals that got like killed and cooked in the fire, and they would eat them because they were so much more delicious, and they could eat lots of it very easily because it was so much more easy to chew and everything else.
Yeah,
and it actually became, and it was, they would be stronger and they felt better about it. You know? So. So the harnessing of fire and what that did for our food is what established civilized man, because all of a sudden now, like you were saying, we harness fire, we create a big fire area, and then the hunters would bring the food in and the gatherers would bring the food in, and it's all around the fire of preparing that, and everybody is there playing their role in anticipation of being able to sustain themselves.
Right.
And that's how we became a society. Like
a group of people.
We grouped together and depended on each other to play all of our own roles that would centralize about feeding us and sustaining us.
Right, exactly.
And so it's a harnessing of fire. So it's primal in us to desire fire-cooked food.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't deny it.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is amazing shit.
It is.
That is incredible.
So right now, you are in the works of getting a developmental kitchen here,
right? Okay. That's right. I'm looking at property. And my first vision was like an old, like, abandoned gas station.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Like 500 square feet of just shop space. That had gas coming into it and water coming into it, and you know, hopefully not too much gas floating around in it on the ground, you know. But I'm not really finding that actually, so, and that's probably a blessing, perhaps. I'm looking at a property or two, and what I want to do with that is I want to convert it into like a very large developmental kitchen. and I want to get equipment, all kinds of really, like, traditional equipment, you know, traditional stove, traditional grill, traditional ovens, a gigantic Italian wood table to just create all kinds of rolling out tortillas or pasta or whatever over the top of it, and have tons of room to just throw flour everywhere. and really, but also, like, one of the properties I'm looking at has a little bit of a garage in the back, and I want to turn that into a bit of a smokehouse. I want to get into canning and preservation because, you know,
you have to can food around here.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, 6 months out of the year, we're not growing shit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So we have to put up food, but you know, there is an art to that. And put up food can be more than grandma's pickled beets. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be not that there's anything wrong with
that. I was just going to say, I was like, hey,
I actually love grandma's pickled beets. Yeah. But, you know, you can preserve mushrooms beyond just drying them. And you can preserve all kinds of things, and the berries, and the people that do the crazy things with choke cherries in this part of the world.
Oh, yeah. Else.
You were saying peaches earlier. We canned when I was a kid.
Right.
And the peaches, if you found an old bottle that my aunt had forgotten about, and you're like, man, I don't even know how old this is, you know? That was what it was. It was so good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like barely holding itself together. It's just been soaking for know, 8-9 years or whatever.
It's amazing.
This might make me sick, but I'm going to take a bite because it's amazing.
Yeah, but you know, the funny thing is I actually believe, and I don't have any medical or scientific or any kind of nutritional training that tells me this is the case. I have some nutritional training, but I don't have anything that tells me this is the case. But, you know, areas of the country where preservation was necessary, I believe that those people who come from that part of the world need to eat put up food during the winter months because their body has developed a way of using that for its nutritional development over the course of time. You know, if you lived in the Amazon where you're you know, eating ants and stuff like that, you got to eat ants. But up here, we got to figure out what we're going to do with food to get us through 6 months of hell.
Yeah, right.
It's absolutely a fact. There was a documentary and I think that
when we eat that stuff, our body goes, okay, I'm good now.
Yeah, I am so in.
It's affected entire cultures.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was a documentary for centuries, and it was in Sweden. They realized there was this brief periods of like two different famines that happened. And the way that it generationally affected the way that people stored their food, they were like mini depressions, sort of, so to speak. And how that quickly changed people's food storage habits. And then there was another famine, and because of the specific things that happened to have been in season during the time when they started canning that stuff, it affected the...
One more glass of wine?
I'll do one more.
I'll have another beer too, please. Thank you.
But it affected they broke it down to where it affected their brain chemistry differently because as a whole, that isolated group of people experienced the same kind of circumstances and had also prepared food-wise. Very much a fluid, moving thing, what people eat and what is happening to their bodies on a generational basis, you know?
Sure.
That's right, and that's so cool. But isn't that
amazing?
It's anthropology. It's culinary anthropology.
Yeah, yeah,
it's cool. It is amazing.
Totally. That's
how
so
can
cool.
you not get excited when you find out about this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure there are people... Like, so, hope none of you, but like, you know, there's some people that are like going, you know, I don't give a shit. Give me my McDonald's. I'm
plus
them,
because you're going to need it.
Yeah.
But for the rest of us, like, wow.
I know.
Well, and that's something actually that has, like, bothered me, like, that I don't know how to do any of that stuff anymore. And, like, I'm literally, like, my uncles, my brothers, like,
I know.
My uncles all, like, they pickled their meat. They pickled their everything. They had a big garden. They had, I mean... And I would always, like, eat anything they sent my way. Like, my one uncle, who recently passed away, he called me the starving pilgrim, because he'd always be like, want to try this pickled meat or whatever, or this canned something other, or this thing? And I'm like, give it to me. I will try.
He'd do weird stuff and be like, I know Andy.
Watch this.
And, you know,
but you had to
all
be a
my
favorite
brothers.
Cousin.
Yeah, exactly. My, you know, all my uncles on that side, they all trapped, they all, you know, On my grandma's side, like, they grew up in the Crazy Mountains. Like, she was the youngest of a family of 14 that grew up in the Crazy Mountains. Like, the game warden turned his head so that they could hunt, like, year-round and stuff. Yeah. Because that was, like, their only sustenance. Like, and to go into town to get your staples, like, your flour and your whatever, was literally, like, a day and a half wagon ride.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, and
then all you got to get is a wagon full.
Yeah. Exactly. And, like, one of her brothers passed away getting rolled over by the wagon on a supply trip to town, you know?
Jeez.
Like, shit was real not that many generations ago. Me out like side of my
yeah,
house.
Yeah, it's totally
in the
Oregon Trail. It's a computer game. Sorry, you got ran over by a wagon.
Or didn't bring enough flour.
Sorry, you came all this way, but you only have enough money for some hardtack and a hammer. So you're gonna starve to death.
Like, I don't even know how to properly like have a food storage like setup that I'm pulling from in the right amounts
right.
and stuff. Like, with all my resources, let alone if I actually had to know how to can everything, how to, you know. And so that's something I'll think about all the time is like, how do people do it? I know that we did this,
but it's
not
in
that
your blood.
Long ago.
You don't get it, man. You just have to get in there. And
that's what I do wish there was like more classes offered on canning and preserving and that. So that is like still knowledge that can be taught and kept because I do feel like that's lost.
But
it has no interest.
Right.
See, that's what this kind of thing needs to do. It needs to generate interest in it because it has no interest. People have no interest.
Yeah.
I conducted so many culinary classes.
I do.
So many culinary classes when I had the restaurant because that was part of my marketing thing was to conduct culinary classes. And, like, I would say, okay, you have a choice from these three classes. Braising, right? Salsas or marinades, right? And, you know, everybody went with salsas. Mm-hmm. But braising would be my favorite, you know, because this is where you go find, like, the cheapest cut or the stuff your uncle gave you that you didn't know
turn the
do,
fat
you know?
Into the part that's going to blow your mind.
Right.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to know anything about braising food. Yes. You know, they don't even get braising food.
Right.
Weird.
Why
pot
would you?
Roast. Like,
exactly.
I don't know about that. Brisket. Oh, okay. Is it smoky?
Yeah,
sometimes, you know. But you don't understand.
Depends how much work you want to put into it.
It's not about smoke. It's about taking something that you can't eat unless you cook it this way.
Right.
Yes.
You cannot get you. You do not have strong enough jaws to get through this shit unless you learn how to cook this stuff.
Yes.
But when you do,
it's amazing.
You will never have a piece of meat that will taste better in your life.
Exactly.
There's not a tenderloin out there that can hold a candle in this shit, man.
Right.
I'm telling you.
Exactly.
You know, but they don't want to know that. It's like canning. It's like, why do I want to learn how to pickle beets? That's that gross shit that I added in the
at Thanksgiving or something.
You know,
for me, it's more about the
food, like in the. The pickled beets that they served you at school lunch
cafeteria.
Or at the salad bar at Shakey's Pizza or whatever shit that was.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, but it's there in your heritage, man. You're into it.
I feel like so many of us have that. And that's like a whole thing. Like, we all need to, like, know that stuff. Because, so for my profession, I'm a trainer and nutritionist. And then, so Nikki Crabb was talking to you the other day about me. Because, like, I'm just hiring her to cook our food now. Because I'm like, screw this. Like, we don't have enough time. I literally missed out on the art form of all of that. And it's in all my family. But I was the baby. And, like, our value system had turned over at that point to your value is in achieving stuff.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I think that, like, a lot of our kids now, it's, like, extracurriculars. That's, like, and we're going to pack literally every evening with extracurriculars. And, like, family dinner is literally being replaced by extracurriculars.
It's ridiculous.
Exactly. Also, my mom was, like, a super simple cook. So, like, you know, she didn't want to, like, switch things up on my dad. So she's like, okay, this is the thing. This works. And so every night was, like, wild game, mashed potatoes, and then wild card was like,
wild
what?
Game, that's awesome.
Well, yeah,
I
like,
get
but like, yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
yeah.
And I love game. But it was always like steak,
four
potatoes,
times at night.
And the wild card was what canned vegetable or whatever, you know? And, but anyway, so, you know, there's a lot, like, the thing is, like, when you know how to, those cooking techniques, it is relevant, and I wish people knew how relevant it was, like, learning how to cook well and learn techniques, because they're not that hard, But that makes you be able to buy that like $1.99 per pound thing at Sam's Club or whatever. So it is.
Bingo.
And so like
and
that's,
cook it for use it. We use the bones, make a broth,
exactly. Right.
Then we crank it up with some bean stew and some honey bean.
And that's why like I'm actually excited. I'm like super excited to see Nikki's meals like laid out like over the course of the week because she was raised with Mexican and Italian cooking blood in her and like you know the sisters would all cook every Sunday. They would have Sunday dinner hot and then the family would go home with their portions of the leftovers and that's what they ate all week. And so the thing is that's how like you know their family is a one teacher income family and they eat organic. They eat really really well. Like all of them have like amidst that family of four there's four different diets because of their stuff.
Right.
And yet she does that on a one teacher salary, which is amazing. And so when people say it's expensive to eat healthy,
they're right.
If you don't know how to do it,
if you don't know how to do it, for sure.
Well, you have to know how to shop, and I mean we've got our work cut out for us, but
we
I think
do.
That we got the right team
it's
to,
so
to
relevant,
begin to do
and
it
it's
because
so important.
Because like one of the things that I always do is, you know, you go to the stores and they often, when it comes to proteins, you know, the animal proteins, you know, there's an expiration on this stuff. And it's interesting because the organic is usually the one that hits the expiration because nobody's buying it because it seems so expensive, right? So
I buy more organic meat on it's like if I cook this tonight
or
freezer
special.
Or freezer
throw it in the freezer, you know. And it, like you can go to Albertsons, man, and it's like it's not hard to find some good organic meat that's 3-4 days away from expiration. And they got it. They've already marked it down 2 or 3 times, and now they got it 30% off. So you're getting a whole like 4-pound, 5-pound chicken. And it was originally at $4.25 a pound, and you're getting the whole chicken for like $8.
Right.
And then roast it. Take it home.
Roast
it in the oven.
Yep.
Roast it.
Yes.
You got a meal that's amazing tonight.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then you got a bunch of like
keep the whole carcass, boil it.
Right.
It's
or even just
amazing
pull all the meat off of it and shred that up and make it into pastas and put it in a noodle or you know, make a chicken salad out of it, make sandwiches for lunch and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then take the carcass and cook up the carcass.
Yes.
And then you have that for soup, which you can set up in different ways. And one of the cool things to do with that, if you stay regular with it, is if you don't know this technique, it's really cool, is you pour that chicken broth into ice cube trays.
Yes, I have heard of that.
And then freeze that. And so if you're in a recipe that it says, and use 6 tablespoons of chicken broth, it's like going, okay, that's 4 ice cubes.
Mm-hmm.
4 ice cubes, you go right in the hot pan, it melts down, and it's in there. Yeah. Right? And the rest just stay in the freezer there.
That's so perfect. You know? You don't have to thaw a whole bag of chicken broth.
Right, or you need a little something to moisten up some, you know, some pulled pork that you had. You just want a little something broth to moisten that up with. Pull an ice cube out and throw them in there. You break it out of the ice cube tray, put it in an ice bag, and you throw it in there.
Yeah.
You know? And the interesting thing about what you're saying is like, you know, people look at it as like, oh, I don't want to do that. It's just so much work and everything. You need to shift your paradigm a little bit.
I know.
Exactly.
Right?
I got a crock pot, dude, and I'm just like, man, I'm a fucking chef now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's awesome.
It is though. It's great because you know it's like $8, and you got food for 2 or 3 days.
Couple days,
and like,
and
you know,
good food.
It is good, you know. Yeah. And I do try to cook, and I'll do it in spurts. You know, I'll have energy and time to do it to like cook, but then it's like got to clean my kitchen after that shit. And like, but dude, the crock pot's easy. It's so lazy and it's kind of limiting, but it is a good first step. We'll say a poor man's way of getting into
the bachelor
cooking.
Version of getting into cooking. Yeah,
you know it is.
You're not
it's
buying like, hot dogs.
And I'm with you.
Yeah.
And the shift to paradigm is to look at it as, oh my God, this is such a chore. And instead of saying, you know what, it's November, and it's Sunday afternoon.
And, you
and
got
we
shit
got the
else
game
to do,
on,
but
right?
Football,
okay, so
yeah.
Now what are we going to do? You know what? You don't have to be sitting on the couch for the game.
Right, yeah, that's true, dude.
So everybody comes over, and you spend from 11 to 5.
Right.
And everybody's got a role. You're all in the kitchen. You're throwing back a couple beers. You're cooking and you're prepping and you're chopping and you're putting everything in little containers and little
you got
bags.
Got food for the week like because of that.
And then for the rest of the week, you come home and you're like, do I want a stir fry? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want a stir fry. I've got partially cooked chicken. I've got cut up onions. I've got cut up peppers. I've got chopped garlic. I got all this stuff. I'm pulling a little of this, a little of that, a little of that. I'm throwing it in a pan. I'm cooking it up, and bam. Mm-hmm. 25 minutes later, I'm eating. And it's all because I had a party in my kitchen
right.
football on Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, and yeah, and everybody's there, and they're going to help you do the cleanup and everything else. And then the cleanup after dinner is pretty easy because it's like one pan and a few bowls.
Right.
You're all good. Or hell with the bowls. Put the pan in the middle of the table and give everybody a fork, and they all just stand around and eat out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it can be that simple.
Some of the best thing we have is, like, you're done with that pot of whatever you're cooking. I'm done with this. Let's just grab some forks. Dig in.
Well, and it is all the way that you look at it. I really like that. You can have Sunday food days.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're already hanging out anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
You can spend if you're cooking. You say you're only going to cook a couple nights a week because you only have time to.
Yeah,
it takes an extra 5 minutes to cook twice as much food.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
So you got the economies.
Exactly. You're already doing it.
You got the economies of scale going on.
Do it twice as much.
Yeah.
And out of the oven, let it cool off, and a bunch of Tupperware.
Yeah.
And then you got leftovers, which is
awesome. Chicken breast is at a good price in the grocery store.
Right, so I'm going to
buy
grab
like 15 chicken breasts.
Yes.
Cook all of them at once.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And then just put them in portions.
I'll do, this one I'm going to do a spicy one. This one I'm going to do straight up Italian. This one I'm going to do just barbecue sauce. And
there you go, and that is
how you have to okay, so this is the other thing that I have an issue with clients is everyone wants a menu plan, and I'm like, the problem with me giving people a menu plan is it doesn't teach them how to think about things.
Right.
So if you're at the store and you were planning on, you know, I don't even know, like steak, just as an extreme example, and chicken's crazy on sale, you know, whatever, like, you know, and so you can't, when you don't know how to think about things, then you're just trying to follow a menu plan. You don't know what you have in your store, what looks fresh that day, what's a good price or whatever. But some of those very basic things, like, I really think that people, if there could just be a format to, like, teach that, the way you can, like, even take, like, online culinary school classes now. But it was literally, like, here's how to, like, just reasonably function as a human with also delicious food. And here's how to think about it. And because then you don't
home
have
ec.
To track.
Yeah, I think it's called home ec.
Yeah, it is.
Got that.
Fucking A.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let's get that shit out
exactly.
of
exactly.
Out of
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah. Our kids don't need to know how to cook
or
order
and balance
a
checkbook. Let's cut
check.
That shit out, too, man.
Is that not always my example? I always say
balance
that.
A checkbook.
All we got to do is get them ready for college, goddammit.
But they won't teach that either.
Susie is in AP chemistry, but
and most of them are really not
going to
get anything other than a big hangover.
And so, you know, what I would love ever to sometime do is just, like, because I want to learn it for myself, and I want it, like, something I'm excited for is, like, with Nicole, seeing how she does things, because she's had to learn how to scale things well and do things efficiently, and then being able to on the weekends kind of be like more like this is a hobby thing as far as getting in touch, learning simple techniques, because it doesn't feel fun to people when it's so foreign to them, you know, like something that's a simple technique or like, oh yeah, throw an ice cube in that, then, you know, throw a broth cube or whatever, that's to other people is like, what, you know, like
I think that this is something that I've noticed too, because I grew up cooking in our house, right? Like, if you wanted to be in the kitchen, you better be serving a purpose, or else mom and or dad is just going to boot you.
Yeah. See, my kitchen better be good at that purpose.
Okay.
Too.
Yeah. I'll kick you out anyhow.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If I could do it three times faster than you, you're not doing it.
You're off. Right. Yeah.
Well, but anyway, I this is something that I've noticed because I've as a you know people my friends whatever be like oh you made this you cooked this whatever like, yeah well man cool you should give me the recipe I'm like well there's no recipe I just made it up.
Yeah
it literally was just eyeballing everything
yeah
and you know, it was really good or whatever and I think the impression that I get is that I feel like people think that it's chemistry. So they see a recipe and they go, well, you need so much of this and so much of that or whatever.
Well,
and
it is
sometimes,
chemistry.
Sometimes you need, yeah. yes, this exact amount or else you're going to ruin it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times it's like literally grab it and smell the seasoning. Does that smell kind of like what you want to eat?
Is that strong
this?
Or is it?
Try yeah. a little bit. You yeah. know? It doesn't, you know, the menu plan thing where like yes. if I don't know exactly what I'm doing the whole way through and it's whatever.
And that's
I'm
where people get overwhelmed with reading recipes. Like even if I give people recipes, they're like, ugh. And I'm like, you don't have to. Okay, like if you don't have kale, use spinach, use whatever. Right. But those are things like when you know people like really honestly like don't know. Yeah. They don't know that. Like,
is that something you're gonna do in this kitchen?
Well, that's why I wanted to bring that up with you, Miranda, mm-hmm. because. First thing is cooking is actually less chemistry. Yeah. There are elements of chemistry in it, mm-hmm. but actually so much of it is physics.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
because
what?
It's what's happening. Like I had a chef in culinary school who used to say, what do you have happening in that pan there? And I said, well, I'm sautéing some peppers. He goes, no. What's happening in that pan? He wanted to know the physical and chemical process that was happening. What happens when you have heat, oil, all these stuff come together with a bell pepper. You know, what happens? What's the physics that happens there? You know, but one of the things is as this developmental kitchen works, it's like going, one of the things I want to do with this is like, let's have some classes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, yes.
Let's find some people that want to learn about something. MG, and we can bring 15 people into there and everybody plays a role. And it would work for corporate like team building exercises, right? You got this like corporate team and stuff like that. Yeah. And like, well, hey, we're going to take a day and we're going to go and we're all going to put together a Thai dish or Italian dish or something.
Then you're going to have like
everybody's going to have a role.
Then you're going to have like three or four more out of every group that are like, oh yeah, do what I want. Fuck this job. I'm going to go cook.
Great. You're going to destroy corporate America. Thanks a lot.
They're teaching them how to cook food.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, so far it hasn't happened within major metropolitan areas. So let us hope. You know,
yeah.
We can hold it.
And that would be
but
so
it's funny because
amazing.
I don't know how much so it's cool. going to be a big corporate like appeal right off the bat right here.
Mm-hmm.
But I have friends like in Washington D.C. mm-hmm. where they just did this sort of thing and they like retired from the kitchen and they were just kind of doing this and they were looking for a way to keep cooking and maybe have some fun and mm-hmm. you know they were doing some stuff and they would like people would want stuff ordered. And, take home and cook for Christmas party and stuff like that, and they would put it in foil and let them take it home and everything. And they just decided to throw that whole like team building, corporate team thing, and they
it's a great idea.
Keep up with it. That like the demand of these all these corporations.
That's
are like
a great
going,
idea.
I'm taking our developmental team on this project, and we're gonna we're starting to get burnout and distracted and everything else. We're all gonna go cook for an entire day, and we're gonna eat, and we're gonna laugh, and we're gonna drink wine, and we're gonna have the time of our life. And when we get back into the office next day, we're gonna be completely refreshed and more together than we've ever been before.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's in our DNA to do that, to come together
because it's
food.
Exactly right.
It works.
Well, here comes the circle.
And it levels the playing field. We got like higher ups like here that are just as novices as or just as,
yeah, or maybe even more.
Not getting nothing
because they've all been like they've all been coddled because they've been so career focused their entire life.
Yeah.
For the guy that's like just walked in there is like going, I'm the fucking like, cook in my ass.
Exactly.
I'm gonna school you, boss.
Exactly.
The boss like, how do you know that chicken's done? I mean, how much do you cook a chicken to when the chicken?
Yeah, how long do you cook it? You cook it till it's done. Well, no. How long is that?
Well, how much is that?
I can tell you.
Dude.
Yeah.
Cut it off with a hook in there.
Yeah.
If you can't do that,
like, no, wiggle it. Wiggle the leg.
Yeah.
Don't ever put a knife in it, man.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up here, because my phone did yell at me and tell me that it was time.
Yes, thank you.
That was
Miranda.
Its job. Mm-hmm. What would be like the last thing you'd want to impart to people then about food?
Don't let the shit scare you, man. And realize that, okay, soapbox for the last thing I said.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, perfect. Soapbox it up.
After World War I and into World War II, our government started to create all this research to how they were going to create food that was quick and
easy. The military.
Yeah, right. Like powdered potatoes, powdered juices,
the
powdered
MREs.
Coffee, everything else like that. Mm-hmm. They were developing all this. Mm-hmm. And the corporations that were doing this work and developing it were like going, okay, when we're out of war, mm-hmm. we don't want to be out of work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we need to figure out how to sell America on eating this food. Which just happened to coincide
with television.
The idea, television is a big, actually, so very true,
right?
That combined with the outwardly mobile society, where, you know, prior to that, multiple generations lived in the same household, mm-hmm. and people didn't leave their hometown and everything else, and all of a sudden, as soon as you got free, you didn't leave the house.
You left
the community, you left the state, you left the coast.
And then you went insane.
You go from West Virginia to California or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, you're not all that familiar, but you're trying to cook, but it's drudgery and everything else. And you have marketing and corporate America that says, it doesn't have to be drudgery. Kentucky Fried Chicken is going to cook for you tonight. Swanson is going to cook for you tonight with TV dinners. Mm-hmm. We are going to do this. You can live the casual life you always wanted, and we will do all the cooking. And there will always be people who will find a way to cheaply give you food that is easy and affordable and approachable. And the only way they can do that is they will have to take so much of the nutritional value out of it, and they will have to add so much of these other ingredients. I mean, you just look at the ingredients.
Preservatives. And
right. I mean, you don't have high fructose corn syrup in your house to cook with, right?
Right.
You don't have sodium bisulfate or whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
Right. You don't have that shit in your house to cook
yeah.
with.
Yeah.
Right. But the food you eat is loaded with that stuff, right?
Right.
And you think it's delicious. Yeah. And so you don't think you can cook that food because you don't have that crap in your kitchen.
Right.
But
because it's not a chemistry.
You just
got to
back up a little bit, man.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. you could
They're
make
trying
this
to emulate food something.
But you have to be willing to say, I want to center our family's life around this process of just being in there, and we're going to hang out, and we're going to talk, and we're all going to cook, and we're going to hang out. It doesn't have to be elaborate. There's ways you can get around that. But you have to understand that this has been a 75-year governmental and corporate approach to pitch you convenience
yes.
and affordability mm-hmm. and ease of life mm-hmm. so that you buy products that were mandated to be developed through history.
Right.
And these companies cannot give it up.
No,
they can't give
right.
it up because it's money-making
okay.
opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so...
Hand over fist.
So, my first thing is recognize that. I'm not saying you got to give it up, but I'm saying just recognize it, acknowledge it, and say, what can I do for me and my family and my kids that brings a little bit of that out of our life? And you will find how much better you feel if you can get that out of there. You will, mark my words, you will feel better. The idea when you eat a meal, when we first started eating, which is when we first became species, was that you felt bad, so you needed food, so you ate, and you felt better. Nowadays, when you go out to eat, if you go to a Denny, and I'm not trying to call out any corporation, but if you go out and eat what is processed and produced for us to eat, you actually feel worse after the meal than you did before.
Hell yeah.
And you think that means you got enough to eat. But the truth is you got sick.
You're now uncomfortable.
Right. You're Thanksgiving uncomfortable. You're like, oh, I got to be one button happy, man. Right? But you're not. Your body is rejecting. Mm-hmm. It's rejecting what you just put in it. And it's bloating you up. And it's making you lethargic. It's making you grumpy. It's making you all these things. And it's what you're eating that's doing that.
Yeah.
And if you go and have a meal and after the meal, you don't feel that. Don't think it's because they didn't give you enough nothing.
Yeah, yes,
right? Mistake. Because when I had my restaurant, and you know, we never gave anybody that feeling, and I promise you, there was plenty of food on the plate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they would say, you know, we had to stop at Burger King on the way home, and I go, well, that's because you got to get sick, because you don't think you ate until you got sick.
Right. You don't feel full. Yeah. You literally don't feel full. Our body's interpretation. Yeah.
So think about that, and
or the way we've
keep
been
tuning
programmed
into
to think
this podcast.
Yeah.
Because I think over time and with blogging and this podcast and other podcasts that I want to do and I think we all would like to be a part of.
Yeah.
I think that we're going to try and help you to learn ways that you can balance it all in your life and find greater satisfaction in your life and more health. And it all comes with time. And I hope that's what we can accomplish through this.
Absolutely.
Yes. It's a worthwhile pursuit.
It is. It is. It literally is.
It is. It is.
Just like.
And tell all your friends, of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Just like. Whether you eat or not is life or death, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what you eat is literally a matter of how you live or your quality
or how you
of life.
Die. Mm-hmm. Also.
Yeah, yep. It is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Maybe more so now than ever before.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Matt
Wallace.
Thank you guys so
much.
Thank you.
This has been awesome. It's been fun.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure to finally meet you.
I love you guys. I mean, this was so fun.
This is the best.
That was Chef Matt Wallace. Peace out.